Program today, and that we have the opportunity to talk to you once again. Or maybe you're joining us for the first time in these strange apocalyptic times. Apocalyptic simply meaning unveiling. Every day now people have revelations about themselves, about other people, their surrounding, and the world that we are experiencing. My name is Henrik, and redeyescreations.com is our website. Agree or disagree, at the end of the day, that doesn't really matter. We're not here to convince you of anything. What we hope to achieve in the process of self-discovery is that we can give you something that will expand your worldview, make you see things in a new light as we highlight research and material from all kinds of different perspectives. And today we are continuing with that tradition together with Anthony Peake. He studied sociology and history at the University of Warwick and at postgraduate level at the London School of Economics. He is a professional member of the Scientific and Medical Network, the International Association of Near-Death Studies, the Society for Physical Research, and the Institute of Noetic Sciences. He is the author of several books and probably best known for his fascinating theory, which he terms Sheeting the Ferryman. It suggests a totally new approach to the nature of consciousness and its relationship with the external world. Anthony has been with us before, as you regular listeners know, and today he returns to Red Eyes Radio to discuss the nature of reality and the twilight zones of consciousness. Well, Anthony, welcome back to Red Eyes Radio. It's great to talk with you once again. How have you been, and what's new, Anthony? I'm looking forward to talking about all the latest stuff, of course.
It has been absolutely an incredible period of time since we last spoke, in that interest in my work is now really taking off worldwide. About 6 months ago, I did a talk at the Weird Festival in Swindon in the UK, and I shared a platform with Graham Hancock. And since then, we have had the Lucid Light device, which we talked about last time. We brought that over to the UK, and the amount of interest in it was just breathtaking. Since then as well, since we last spoke, I've now written three more books. There are two more books that came out in November, and I have another book coming out in 2 months' time as well. I'm also now the major speaker at this year's Mind, Body and Spirit Festival in London. And what is exciting about this is we're bringing over a Lucid Light device, which will be at the festival for 4 or 5 days. And we're also hoping that a gentleman by the name of Mitch Schultz, who I think you've interviewed in the past,
is
an associate of Rick Strassman. Mitch is going to be coming over as well, and we're going to be doing a special showing of the movie The Spirit Molecule. So, and I will then be doing a two-hour workshop on the Sunday afternoon, I think it's the 2nd of June, 2nd or 3rd of June. So it's amazing. And on top of that, literally today, being Groundhog Day of all days as well, is that somebody I've been in contact intermittently over the last few years is the American scriptwriter Danny Rubin. And Danny was the guy that wrote the screenplay for the movie Groundhog Day. And Danny and I now are in regular and direct contact. And Danny, in fact, has just brought out a book on the writing of Groundhog Day. But on top of that, today as well, 14 times reviewed my out-of-the-body experience book and gave it a 9 out of 10 and gave it an absolute rave review. And I'd like to thank Bob Rickard for an actually incredible review on it. So things are just kicking off over and just across the world. It's absolutely incredible. And we think we are now about to move from being sort of a minority interest in terms of myself and my group to being something quite phenomenal worldwide. And I have to say that Red Ice have been absolutely instrumental in this, because the amount of people who have approached me after listening to the recordings that we've done in these shows has been marvelous. You know, and all of us, thank you so much for your continued interest in my work.
Oh, you bet. I mean, that's excellent to hear. Really good. And I'm glad to hear that people out there are listening, of course, and taking an interest. And to me, it's really exciting that all these seemingly disconnected subject fields are beginning, if you will, to communicate with each other, or the researchers are doing it. Everything from life after death to nature of reality to the physics, if you will, of the soul, and also now stretching into the DMT, the hallucinogenic kind of subject matter as well with some of Strassman's work. So that must be really exciting for you as well to be kind of in the middle of all that, if you know.
It is, and I very much do feel I'm in the middle of it. I mean, interestingly enough, 2 weeks' time, in the afternoon, 2 weeks' time, I'm being interviewed by a lady called Dr. Manjeer Samantha Lawton, who's written a book called Punk Science, Inside the Mind of God, which is proving very, very popular in the UK and America. And she is putting together a movie come documentary about her work in terms of quantum physics and consciousness. And I'm going to be interviewed at the Institute of Physics in London by Manjeer to discuss my particular angle on all this. But after that, I'm then going into central London. I'm meeting up with a guy called Gary Lachman, who, again, I think you've possibly interviewed in the past.
No, unfamiliar name to me. Tell us a little bit about him.
Gary, I can facilitate something on this for you. Gary Lachman is a fascinating guy. As Gary Valentine, he was the bass guitarist of the rock band Blondie.
Mm-hmm.
And after moving on for Blondie, he then performed with Iggy Pop and various other New Wave New York bands. But his interest has always been the esoteric. And he is an absolute expert on Peter Ouspensky and has written probably the definitive book on Ouspensky. But on top of that, he's written various other books on just the Western esoteric traditions. And he and I spent a fascinating few hours around about 3 or 4 months ago discussing our respective points of view in terms of this. But ironically enough, he wrote an article in 14 Times on the phenomenon known as hypnagogia, which is that liminal state between sleeping and waking. In fact, just before you go to sleep in the evening, it's called hypnagogia. And when just as you wake up, it's called hypnopompia. And both of these are kind of states whereby human consciousness seems to open up the doors of perception, as William Blake called them, and latterly Aldous Huxley, to be in a position whereby you start to perceive the reality behind the reality, as the Gnostics would say. Now, Gary wrote an article about this, and in the article he cited a phenomenal book called Hypnagogia, written by a Greek academic called Dr. Andreas Mavromatis. Now, I did the launch for my new book at Watkins Bookshop in November, and Andreas turned up at the lecture, and I was absolutely delighted that somebody that's been one of my intellectual heroes for many years turned up. But what is amazing is that Gary has cited Dr. Mavromatis' work many, many times, but the two of them have never met up. So I'm in the facilitating the meeting between Gary Lachman and Dr. Andreas Mavromatis, and we're also hoping that Dr. Manjeer Samantha Lawton will also join us. So we're having this amazing meetings of minds that it seems as if fate is conspiring to draw us all together. Now, on top of this, there's also, I don't know if you've read the work of a guy called Jeff Warren.
No, also I'm familiar, actually, yeah.
Okay, Jeff Warren is, I think he may be Canadian or American. I'm not quite sure exactly his background nationality. But Jeff wrote an amazing book called Head Trip. And Head Trip is like a travel book where he travels the world talking to people who deal with the further reaches of consciousness and how consciousness interfaces with other realities. And he has in his book a large section again on Dr. Andreas Mavromatis and his book on hypnagogia. And again, I'm facilitating contact between these two guys. And it seems to me it's like a huge Venn diagram where it's like the spokes of a wheel. And I seem to be in the center of this wheel, facilitating contact between people who ordinarily wouldn't be in contact with each other.
Hmm.
And it's an incredibly humbling experience because I'm also keen to get Tom Campbell involved in this. There are various other individuals that Professor Irvin Laszlo,
right.
Quite keen to get Irvin Laszlo involved in it all as well, because we are really genuinely building up a new paradigm here, you know, and it's a new paradigm that is divorced from what I would consider the wackier elements of New Ageism. In the sense, what we're doing is we're doing the hard science. We're not just sitting back and talking about experiences. We're trying to understand why it is that the brain functions in the way it does. How does it open these channels of communication with alternate realities? Are these alternate realities genuine realities, or are they something more? Now, again, interestingly enough, I was talking to Graham Hancock about this before a talk we both did that we shared a platform again in September of last year. And of course, as you know, Graham is also working on the implications of ayahuasca and dimethyltryptamine as well.
That's right.
So we're all going in the same journey. We're all going on the same direction, but we're all approaching it from subtly different areas. And I am surprised to discover that I seem to be the eye of the hurricane at the moment in terms of what it
well, that's exciting. How is it progressing overall? Do you feel from your perspective then what is being learned, I guess, is the bigger question.
Oh, it is like an amazing toboggan ride at the moment, in that everything I seem to touch seems to grow. You know, and every time I contact somebody, there is information that can be gleaned that I can bring together for my overall wider hypothesis about the nature of consciousness and reality. And really, sometimes I cannot even believe how fast this is growing and developing. Because people are just getting involved from around the world. I'm getting contacts now from people from China, people from Australia, people from Canada. All the time people are contacting me. And for instance, Danny Rubin informs me that he has given copies of my first book, Is There Life After Death, to all of his close friends. Because he says this guy's done the science of Groundhog Day, even though at the time Danny had not realized exactly the level of esoteric thought that people would place on his overall plot. Because, as you know, people have turned around and said, was Danny writing Buddhism? Was he writing Nietzsche? Was he writing various other ways of the eternal recurrence, the eternal return? Or was he writing something of profound significance for the future of humanity? Well, of course, all Danny was doing was he was writing a screenplay. And that's all his intention was. And his new book that has recently come out, it was launched, I think, last week, which is called Groundhog Day, writing the screenplay, I think, of something like that. He tells you exactly how he wrote the book and where the ideas came from. And I believe what's happening is that worldwide there is some kind of an awakening going on. People are becoming... I'm not a great believer in the whole 2012 thing, but what I do believe is that people, certainly, are waking up to a much wider understanding of the nature of reality and a much more open worldview. You know, the idea of that we're stuck in the science of 110 years ago is passé now. Mm. You know, if you read some of the latest research and some of the work being done even by people like Stephen Hawking, for example, Stephen Hawking is working with a guy called Thomas Hertog at CERN, and Hawking and Hertog have written a series of papers suggesting that the many worlds interpretation of particle physics as put forward by Hugh Everett III can actually be proven now in terms of the observed behavior of subatomic particles, to the extent that Hawking, and remember, this is Stephen Hawking, this isn't some guy down coming up with his ideas by just reading things. Hawking is considered to be probably the most famous intellectual particle physicist the world has ever seen. And Hawking is suggesting, and get this, Hawking and Hertog are suggesting that every potential reality and every outcome of every event and every outcome of every particle event actually exists out there as a potentiality. It exists as a potentiality. It is not that it will come to being as you take decisions, but it's out there. And all we do is we collapse the wave function of that particular outcome by our actions, which effectively means that other variations of us who follow other different actions collapse different wave functions, and in which case bring about different universes. Now, this is Stephen Hawking. You know, this is incredibly exciting. you know, and his associate, you know, is one of the top research scientists at CERN. Now, of course, we also have the phenomenon of the Higgs boson.
Right.
And the discovery of the Higgs boson as well, which in itself has massive implications for the nature of reality, which is somewhat being understated by the press. But if you read the really serious books on this subject, the implications for this is phenomenal. The discovery recently in terms of the superluminal speed of these muons that was discovered before Christmas, the implications for this are phenomenal as well, because it suggests that Einstein's barrier on light speed suddenly doesn't exist anymore, which of course would explain some of the phenomena that are seen, such as superposition and entanglement. This suddenly could explain why we can have instantaneous communication between subatomic particles. And this is simply because, of course, everything is a oneness. The reality that we perceive it, that is separated in the terms that it is separated by geographical space and such like, in fact, is an illusion brought about by the human mind. Space is not as it seems, as time is not as it seems. Hmm. What we're doing is we're discovering now that consciousness, other than being just an epiphenomenon of the brain, is actually central to everything we perceive around us. Which, of course, Niels Bohr suggested back in the late 1920s with his Copenhagen interpretation.
Well, exactly. That was one of the points I want to try to get to here, that it seems like we've gone on a little detour, science overall, Anthony, and finally now we're catching up to some of the ideas that were out there in the early 1900s or so, and we're kind of going back to that now, basically. That's what I see, anyway.
Very much so. What is happening is, I think the issue has been that the sciences such as biology have rather fallen behind in terms of quantum physics. And of course the reason for this is quite logical, because particle physics is illogical. It is not common sense. It doesn't fit in with our overall comfortable Newtonian worldview of cause and effect. It doesn't work that way. You can have particles in two places at the same time. You can have particles instantaneously communicating. For instance, I was surprised to discover that a guy called Anton Zeilinger, who works at the University of Vienna, has been working on particles where he's entangled particles, and then he's bounced these particles off low-lying geostationary satellites in space. And these particles have shown, again, as they've regularly discovered, that if you take one action on one particle, the other one instantaneously reacts. Now, many, many traditional scientists will say this is a misinterpretation of the facts. They will argue that it is mathematical equations and that the people like myself are misinterpreting this. This is not the case. There was Bruce Rosenberg, who is professor of physics at the University of Los Angeles, wrote a book 3 or 4 years ago called Consciousness, Physics Encounters Consciousness, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And in this he discusses in great detail and stipulates quite precisely that it's not a misinterpretation. The fact is that quantum physics suggests a reality that is counterintuitive, but is the opening of a completely new science. And indeed, one of the areas I'm quite intrigued with at the moment is something called Bose-Einstein condensates and the implications for something called the zero-point field, which I'll come on to slightly later. But effectively, all these things suggest that we are on the edge of radical new discoveries in terms of science, radical new ways of understanding consciousness. Because after all, you know, whenever I discuss these things with materialists, materialist scientists, and materialist reductionists, I always make the point, and it's not an original point, but I still think it's a very valid one, that materialist reductionist science is the science of taking things apart in order to understand how they work. So, for instance, if I want to understand how a motorbike functions, I take it apart and I take the engine apart bit by bit and then put it back together again. And by doing so, I will understand how the engine works. But this is analogous in many ways to what we're doing with particle physics, in the sense that there's another thing, that you take a motorbike apart in order to discover the speed. And of course, you're not going to discover the speed by taking it apart, because the speed is an epiphenomenon of the motorbike. It's a secondary factor
right.
of the motorbike.
Yeah.
And this is the same with consciousness in the brain. If you take the brain apart, we look into the brain and we look into the neurons and we look at the neurological pathways, we can do CAT scans, we can do MRI scans that will tell us exactly which parts of the brain fire up when certain thoughts are thought and when certain motivations take place. We can probably understand which parts of the brain do what. But in none of this analysis have we ever been able to analyze a thought, an emotion, the substances that philosophers have long discussed, this concept of qualia, the concept of the intensity of red, the concept even of pain. You know, effectively, if I have a pain in my finger, you could take my brain apart till the cows come home, but you still won't find the location of that pain.
Right.
Because pain does not exist unless there is a person perceiving that pain. Now, you can extrapolate that inference and say that in which case, everything we perceive in reality out there is in one way or another a qualia. It is something that is created by the brain to be presented to a consciousness. Without the consciousness perceiving it, there isn't the external universe. We're drawing up information, as Professor Irvin Laszlo did when he took the ideas of David Bohm. Laszlo and Bohm say that everything is digital, everything is energy. All that happens is the human brain processes that information and creates a three-dimensional external reality that seems to be solid. But of course, as we discovered when we had our two-hour discussion with Tom Campbell, taking that to its logical conclusion doesn't work.
Yeah.
Because reality, when you take it down to its component parts, is 99.99999% empty space. And what is left is, in fact, vibrations within a field.
Hmm.
So there's nothing out there.
How much would you say that we are creating then? If we're looking for, this is a fascinating riddle, Anthony. I mean, if we create reality and yet we're trying to find the root of it, what are we going to find? We're going to find ourselves there in a way, kind of looking for these riddles and try to solve them. Whatever we project or maybe what we even think we might find out there might be something that echoes back to us. Is there a way that we really can get to the root of it, or is the nature of reality so elusive, such a mystery that we can't nail it? What do you think?
Well, there is an argument that is used many, many times to say that anything that exists within a system cannot ever understand the whole system because we're part of it. In other words, you know, I'm reminded of the famous Abbott book about Flatland. You know, the book written around about 1854, I think, by a school teacher. And the idea that that we cannot perceive, if we are three-dimensional beings, we can't perceive a universe in four dimensions. In other words, we can't even necessarily perceive a reality if we bring time in, that Minkowski suggested in his terms of his block time concepts. But indeed, there are now supposedly many more dimensions wrapped up within themselves. If you listen to string theory, they will argue that there are many, many more dimensions of reality. But if we can't perceive these realities, and the instruments we design can't perceive these realities, these will forever be hidden to us. You know, we will never necessarily understand them. The only way we can extrapolate the information is by either using mathematical models, mathematical language, or else we need a radical rethinking of exactly what we think reality is. Now, I believe that the secret lies in the concept of zero-point energy and the zero-point field. I think this is where the answer may lie.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that empty space and the reality we perceive out there, when we perceive it to be a vacuum, is in fact the complete opposite. It's a plenum. It's absolutely full of energy. And this energy is, we attune into this energy like vibrations, like, you know, the way in which a string vibrates depending upon how it's energized. And I think in some way the human brain picks up this energy form. Now, if this is the case, there is a suggestion to say, and again, I'm not original on this, it was very much suggested by Irvin Laszlo, and if you go back to David Bohm and people like that, it's something they've been talking about for a long time, that reality itself and consciousness are all part reality. In other words, when you look at the philosophy and the philosophical arguments about the nature of consciousness and reality, we fall into the trap of dualism, the Descartesian dualism, and the idea that either there are two substances in existence, there is physical matter and there is thought. The question has always been, how does thought influence matter? And it's a very intriguing point, because it's the idea of, I choose to move my arm, or I'm choosing at the moment to move my larynx in certain ways in order to have the air run past my larynx so that I can make sounds and I can communicate those sounds. Now, what is happening here is my brain is doing this. And my brain is doing it by sending signals from my brain to my larynx to make it move in a particular way. However, what is making the brain do that is whatever I am in my head. Now, I'm a non-physical thing. You know, my thoughts are non-physical. My consciousness is non-physical, as we've discussed before. Mm. And the question is, how does something non-physical become the motive force of physical action within the universe? And this is...
Unless, of course, our conception of what is physical is faulty or erroneous.
Correct. And this is the point I'm going to make, is that what we're doing is we are observing two phenomena that we think are different phenomena. And it reminds me of a wonderful story that David Bohm once used when he was trying to explain how two particles can seemingly be to seem to copy each other in terms of movement. Because what has been noticed is that if you entangle two particles and you spin them off into different directions, it's something called the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen thought experiment, but effectively it was proven scientifically by Alain Aspect in 1981 using something called Bell's inequality. I won't go into the details of that now. But basically what they find is that if you have two particles, you entangle them, you do one thing to one particle, the one reacts immediately. Now, David Bohm used a wonderful example in his book, The Implicate Order, where he said, imagine a scenario that we are in communication with an alien species that are thousands of light years away. And there is some way that we can communicate with them by sending them pictures, which they get instantaneously. And the process is immaterial. We know that's impossible, but just bear with me for this for a second. Mm-hmm. So what the people on Earth do is there's an aquarium, and there's one fish in the aquarium. And what they do is they place one video camera at the front of the aquarium and another one at the side. And they send two signals to our alien friends. And the alien friends have two television screens. And they've never seen a fish before. And because the cameras are filming from slightly different from different angles, there is no immediate way that you can tell that it's one fish. You assume it's two, because the fish will move in different directions because the camera angles are different. So the aliens will assume that there are two particles. However, a very, very bright alien notices that there's a relationship. When one fish moves in one direction, the other one seems to move in a different direction, but there seems to be a relationship between the two. They seem to be communicating instantaneously. And again, rather like the scientists on Earth when they discovered superposition, they thought, this is quite strange, why does this happen? But at a lower level reality, one of the aliens points out that maybe we are looking at one fish from different angles. Now, this is what might be happening with subatomic particles, in the sense that at a much deeper level of reality, what we consider to be two particles are in fact one. Now, if we're discussing this in terms of electrons, it's logical to conclude that every electron is related to every other electron. Now, you may or may not be aware of this, but one of the greatest theoretical physicists of the late 20th century was a guy called Richard Feynman. And Richard Feynman once suggested in a lecture that the reason that we see these things the way we do is that the universe consists of literally one electron moving at infinite speed, in which case everything that we perceive is related. And of course, this is exactly what David Bohm said, that we're perceiving reality in a completely different way. And of course, this goes back then to the Hindu belief systems, the Buddhist belief system about the oneness, that there is no duality. Everything is non-dual. So in which case, the real reality behind the reality is a oneness, a timeless oneness. Mm. Now, again, it was an intrigue. I had an intriguing meeting with Professor Jeff Forshaw. Now, Jeff Forshaw is the youngest British professor of physics, I think, in history. And he has the chair of physics at Manchester University, indeed in the same building where Rutherford split the atom. And one of his PhD students is, in fact, Brian Cox, who's very popular on UK television. Now, Jeff and I both were invited to do a talk at the National Theatre in London about 3 years ago. And we met up for coffee at Manchester University a week or two before we were due for the event. And again, Jeff turned round to me over coffee and said, of course, we know that every electron in the universe knows the location of every other electron. So yet again, this is actual observed science. Mm. You know, this is something that is observed, but we're interpreting it in a different way. Now, if it means that every particle in the universe is in effect related to every other particle, it means that the way we perceive reality with distance, because of course one of the great mysteries is space. You know, if there was nothing in space, as Ernest Mach said, if there was nothing in space, would space exist? You know, think about this again. The universe exists because there are objects in it. If there were no objects in the universe, space is literally empty. So if there were no objects, say there were only two objects in the universe, two planets, one of them ceases to exist, the universe would then shrink to that single planet. And if that disappeared, nothing would exist.
But that doesn't make sense, does it?
No, it doesn't. And it's one of these things, again, that if you talk to scientists about the mystery of space, the idea is the distance between particles or the distance between objects, is it a distance in time or is it a distance in space?
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, space and time are related. And if space and time are the same thing, which, of course, Einstein said they were, you take time out of the equation or space out of the equation, what do you end up with? You end up with this kind of emptiness, this darkness. Now, the latest research is suggesting this zero point energy is the energy that exists within the vacuum. And indeed, it was first discovered or first suggested back around about 1947 when a Dutch physicist called Casimir noticed that if you place two metal plates inside a vacuum tube, even though there's a vacuum in there, the two plates seem to be pushed together. And he came to the conclusion that there's a form of energy that exists within the vacuum of space itself. Now, this energy, if it exists, I believe, is what the Hindus call the Akashic record, the Akashic field.
Mm.
It is the information field. It's what creates everything. It is where thought comes from. It creates the illusion around us using holograms and using holographic techniques. In other words, reality that we see around us is non-physical. Everything is non-physical.
And therefore, this also explains the idea that everything is in all-knowing, it's in constant communication with itself in that sense, and hence we also actually have some kind of verification here for some of the more paranormal sciences perhaps as well. I mean, Rupert Sheldrake talked about the morphogenetic fields. There are people who are talking about the fact that they are in communication telepathically with other people, with even other beings, Anthony.
Yeah, well, funny enough, there was something very curious happened to me last weekend. I was invited to be a speaker at a place called the Arthur Findlay College near Stansted Airport. And I was invited along. It was a week-long discussion between scientists and mediums, medium people. And one of my friends, Susan Laybourne, was giving a series of talks, and she invited me along to one of them before I did my major presentation. And she asked me to stand up, and there were a group of about 15 people in the room. And she said, now what you need to do is imagine that there is somebody on your shoulder trying to communicate with you. And then she said, let your mind go blank and just let the ideas flow into your mind. Now, I'd say that by making my mind go blank, I could be attuning into the zero point field. zero point energy, because what you do is you go into this kind of quasi-hypnagogic state and you start to draw up information from somewhere. Now, much to my surprise, and it did stun me because this has never happened to me before, I had certain images come into my mind, and one particular image was of a schoolgirl being hit on the back of the neck. And we had a person in the audience who was a school teacher. And the Susan then turned around to me. She said, "Think about something significant about our school teacher friend over here, something you can attune into." And immediately in my mind, I had a vision of a kitchen being renovated, and the kitchen, the doors on the kitchen units were off. In other words, it was really quite a curious view that the doors weren't on the kitchen units. And this is what I announced. And the woman was stunned, as I was, because apparently that was literally what was happening at that time at her home, where she was having a new kitchen put in. Now, there is no possible way I could have known that. And yet, somehow, I picked that up.
This is remote viewing that you're talking about right here.
Almost. Whether it was remote viewing, whether it was some form of telepathy, whether I picked up the thoughts within her mind, or was it sheer coincidence? But to me, to say that is a coincidence is really begging massive questions.
Yeah.
Why would I think about something so obscure? And it did surprise me, because I then came to the conclusion that really what is happening with mediums is that they are attuning in, some of them, into this Akashic field and Akashic record. And when I did my presentation to all the representatives at the conference, and we had people from the Netherlands, we had people from Denmark, we had people from Germany, and I very much put it, my Damon Adelon idea, and the idea that we all have a higher self that has lived this life before. And I was suggesting to the mediums that their spirit guides are in fact their self, their Damon. And I was expecting them all to be very, very upset about this. They weren't. It was incredible. The amount of that they came over to me and they said, I've spent most of my life trying to understand what is happening, and you've explained it in 2 hours. So clearly there is a deeper well of information. Could this explain, for instance, hypnotic regression? When people seemingly attune into past lives, is it that they are really living or remembering a life that they have lived? Or is there out there a huge record of information? It's very much what Tom Campbell would argue, that there is an informational field out there. And we attune into it. It's again what Jung would consider to be the collective unconscious. And we attune into this. And our brain, when they are in certain brain states, the brain can attune into this and pick this information up and pull it up through the neurons of the brain and manifest within our mind.
This is fascinating. There's a couple of things I want to ask you pertaining to this. When we talk about the zero point field or zero point energy, there is a lot of people obviously working with this idea of how also we mankind can tap into this to utilize and solve some of our energy crisis and so forth. But do you think our understanding of this is vital to be able to pull this off? In other words, we need to have a realization perhaps about how this works before we en masse, if we will, could begin to tap into this field, if that is even doable or even suggestible. But because it's almost like something needs to give way. We're walking around the subject matter. We can kind of understand that it's there, but no one really knows how to get to it, if you will, Anthony.
No, absolutely. That is the major issue at the moment, is that theoretically the zero point field exists. The question is how we draw this energy up. And of course, the major problem is it's called a zero point field because it exists and the energy manifests itself within the vacuum of space. And in fact, at absolute zero, 272 point whatever it is, degrees Kelvin. So the problem would be is that it can only manifest at these very, very low temperatures. But on top of that, I am aware that there is a firm in Boulder, Colorado, that have received an American patent to start developing ways by which we can draw this information, this energy, for want of a better term, up. But if this energy is in fact the ground energy force of everything that is and everything that's manifest, we're looking in the wrong way, because if this energy is somehow linked to consciousness and that we are like waves on this huge ocean of zero point energy, the energy we can use effectively because we manipulate our own reality. And in which case, if we can create the energy ourselves, we can manifest it. Now, I'm not somebody that is a great believer in the idea of, thinking things and they will happen, and you want to be a millionaire. So if you think very, very hard, this will all come to you. I mean, that's not something I believe in. Mm. But that is extrapolating from very much the Copenhagen interpretation of particle physics, that particles are waves until they're observed. And when they're not observed, they are waves. Now, again, people turn around to me and say, no, that cannot be real. But effectively it is, as you're probably aware, that if you fire a stream of light or a stream of any form of electromagnetic energy through two parallel slits, if you fire them and you don't have a detecting device on the slits, it continues to be a wave, goes through the two slits as a wave, and then gives a wave pattern, as you would expect with a wave on a board or a sensor at the other side.
That's a good idea, but how do we know that if we don't have a detector to measure that?
Well, what happens is quite simple. What they do is they peek. So what they did was they literally placed a measuring device on one or other of the slits. And when they did that, the wave became a series of particles. And the wave and the interference pattern on the back of the wall ceased to be an interference pattern and became two bands of light. When they take the measuring device away, it goes back to being a wave. Now, this is stunning. And I don't think a lot of people it's really dawned on people exactly what this means.
Yeah, you're right.
And again, it's what Bruce Rosenberg says in his book. So just to talk it through again. So you have a stream of electromagnetic energy. You fire it through two slits. If you do not have a measuring device on the slits, it goes through as a wave, and it proves it's a wave because you get an interference pattern on the back wall or on the measuring device. If, however, you place a measuring device of any description on one or other of the, or both of the slits, the wave has to choose to go through one or other of the slits, and it does. It is observed to go through one or the other of the slits, which means it's a particle. And when it does that, it gives a totally different pattern on the back wall. Or on the measuring device at the back. And it does this consistently. So it means if the particles know they're being observed, they react because they know they're being looked at. Now, people turn around to me and say, oh, well, it's electromagnetic waves. Well, that's what light is. But what is more intriguing is they have reproduced these experiments with molecules, very large molecules. In fact, a buckyball, I think, has somewhere in the region of 64 atoms in it. And buckyballs do exactly the same thing. When they're observed, they go through as a wave. When they're unobserved, they go through as a wave. But when they don't, they go through as particles. Now, this means that the observed universe is observed and is physically present in three-dimensional space because it is observed or measured. If there were no sentient beings and no measuring devices in the universe, there would be nothing here. Now, that's intriguing.
Intriguing.
Yeah. There would be electromagnetic energy, but it wouldn't coalesce into particles.
Yeah.
Now, of course, it could be I have grossly misunderstood that, but this is how I understand it to be, and every book I've read on the subject very much reinforces this model. And it is the materialist reductionists that are deliberately ignoring the implications of the twin slit experiment.
Now, what about the quality, if you will, of the consciousness that is doing the observing as well. Because if we go back to the concept that you mentioned earlier here, hypnagogia, fascinating idea. I think actually had a whiff of that yesterday, last night, by the way. But what is happening in the brain? Why is it that when we're in this twilight zone, if you will, between waking and sleeping, that we can tap into the or lift the veil to reality in one sense, and not when we're in our regular state, and going on from there then as well, maybe we can talk about how observed reality would act differently in different kinds of states of consciousness, if you will.
Well, I think what is happening here is that the brain functions on vibrational levels. And the brain, the thing that people talk about, brain waves. Now, effectively, when we are wide awake, there are different kind of brain states. But then as we go into meditation, we go into what's called alpha state. Then when we're anxious and everything, we go into beta. But there are also something called theta waves, when the brain vibrates at certain levels, or the electrical field around the brain is resonating at a certain level. And I think when we resonate at this particular level, we seem to attune into something else. And I think what is happening here, and this brings it beautifully in to my overall model, because what I think is happening here is that consciousness is, when they're in these states, we draw information up from the zero-point field. Now, how this occurs is quite a complex model, because I think what is happening is that there are very, very small structures in the brain called microtubules, and these are very, very small structures of protein that are found inside the neurons of the brain. There are literally trillions and trillions of these. Now, these are so small that when I was discussing before about a wave being a particle or a wave, the choice of being a particle or a wave can affect the behavior of these microtubules. The microtubules can sense in some way these subtle changes with subatomic particles. And I think what they do is, and it is really quite surprising me this, to discover that microtubules are like little machines for creating holograms. Apparently they give off light, single photon light. They're like, there's two sides to a microtubule. They're like two lines of protein. Mm. And they give off towards each other. They give off single photons of light or electromagnetic energy. And these photons, when they get to the center between the two, they bring about interference patterns in exactly the same way as a hologram does. Now, it is possible that trillions and trillions of microtubules resonating at a certain energy level can create holographic images. And these are the holographic images that we perceive as reality. Okay? Mm-hmm. So, because there's been the great mystery of how the brain creates the inner reality from the external stimuli it receives. For instance, it has long intrigued me as to how my overall, and I'll suggest this to any listeners out there, anybody listening to this broadcast, just look around the room you're in at the moment and realize that everything you're seeing is being created by your brain from a piece of energy on the back of your retina that's inverted and the size of a postage stamp. And that's all that is hitting the back of your retina. Your brain is converting that into electronic signals, electrical impulses, which then go into your brain, to the area of your brain that is the visual cortex. And that then reconstitutes all that information from the electrical impulses it's received, and it recreates from these electrical impulses the whole image that you are seeing around you. Now, that is sheer magic.
That means none of the light particles in the room or the entire universe is actually going into your brain, correct, in that sense.
Correct. Yeah. And what is even more intriguing about this, and when I first discovered this, when I read about it, it amazed me, is that when you look out of a window and you see the image from the other side of the window, you naturally assume that the photons of light that are hitting your eye are the photons of light that have bounced off the tree that you can see the other side of your window. That's not what's happening. Mm. The photons that you are perceiving, the process is that, you know, the light comes from the sun. The photons then bounce off the tree and hit the window. When they hit the window, one photon hits another photon. One photon hits the atoms in the window, which then suck one of the photons in and eject another photon. And as it goes through the glass, it does this many, many times. So the photons that come through the other side of the glass are not the same photons. The photon then goes into your eye and then goes through the aqueous humor inside your eye, which means it keeps getting changed and changed and changed. And then it hits your retina, and then it's converted into an electric signal, which then goes down the neurons of the brain, goes down something called the optic chiasma, and the suprachiasmic nuclei in the brain, and then goes to the place that then recreates the picture. It recreates it. The reality you perceive is not the reality that's necessarily out there.
Now we can understand better this idea of seeing why we're seeing things literally from a different perspective, or why we can understand why people have a difference of an event, something that happened. We were talking about layers after layers after layers of both interpretation, of course, by the consciousness itself to perceive things that are happening. But as you say, even actually the photon particles themselves are echoes of each other. It's amazing. We can either even order a cup of coffee in a cafe to make it work, you know, when you think about it.
And it's the idea, isn't it? Is it because, you know, there's the term I use very much in my book on the out-of-body experience. It's not, again, original term, but the idea of consensual reality. The reality we perceive out there, we agree that it exists because we believe, we all agree that the things we see are the same. But we can't even agree with the color red, because I cannot ever describe to you what I see when I see red. We both agree that a certain section of the electromagnetic spectrum is a color. But my eyes may stimulate totally different areas of the color patterns within my brain than yours do. But we both interpret that color as being red, because everything we see that is red is the same color. But we don't know whether that, our perception, is the same color.
That's right.
And it's because the way the brain processes it again. And I know people will turn around and say, well, it's to do with the particular vibrations of that particular part of the electromagnetic spectrum. But it's not that. It's more than that. It's, again, this question of qualia. And one of the great mysteries, you know, is just how the brain does this, because it's not just doing it with sight, is it? It's doing it with your hearing.
Exactly. Everything, yeah.
It's doing it with your somasensory cortex, the idea of knowing where your body is positioned in space. And this, again, is a great problem, you know, to scientists, because it's something called the binding problem. It's the idea of where does it all come together in the brain. For example, why do I feel that everything is simultaneous? Because the signals, the way in which the neurons of the body and the nerves of the body conduct signals are different speeds. They depend whether the neurons are myelinated or not, and different speeds are coming in and are being processed in different parts of the brain. You know, there's the visual cortex, where I hear things are processed in a different place, and yet I feel that everything is happening simultaneously. And this is because consciousness buffers information before it's presented to consciousness. This is why you jump before you actually hear a bang. It's because everything is being buffered. And if it's being buffered, it's being recorded. So it becomes more and more intriguing. You know, people tend to think they understand how they function until they start to think about it. And when you think about it, what we understand to be our explanations of consciousness and perception, you know, there is not a little Anthony Peak inside my head that is pulling it all together.
Right.
You know, what is doing the perceiving? And of course, the Buddhists would say nothing is doing the perceiving because it's an illusion. If you look inwardly to suddenly, you know, when you do deep meditation and you say, well, who am I? What am I? Am I my body? Am I my brain? Am I my neurons? And if I then turn around and say I'm none of those things, the question is, what am I? I'm something that uses my body to interface with some form of external reality. But I could be anywhere, couldn't I? Mm-hmm. I don't have to be in my body. My body could be like a machine that gives me an idea of three-dimensional reality. It processes it like a virtual reality machine.
Absolutely fascinating. There's so much more to talk about. I'm reminded of something, I think it was Robert Anton Wilson actually talked about that at the same time we can have this philosophy that we can question who am I in all this. At the same time, we are the ones who are pulling all of this together, because from our particular perspective, we are at the center of the universe. Everything is happening, you know, from my perspective, from me and outward, so yep. to speak, in that sense. And I am the one, therefore, from a, you know, kind of magician's point of view, that's making the green grass, if you know what I mean, Anthony. Fascinating.
And that is a profoundly important observation. The idea that it's going back to the old Berkeleyism and the idea that the only thing I can know with absolute certitude is that I am. That I'm perceiving. S.E. Precipi, I think he called it. The idea of to be is to perceive.
Yep.
Because that's the only thing we know. Now, for instance, people turn around to me and say, well, if external reality is illusion, how come when I go to bed at night and I dream, when I wake up the next morning, my bedroom is still the same as it was when I went to bed? When I get up, the people I interface with, my job, and everything around me is the same. But imagine a scenario that your dream lasts a lifetime, in which case you are dreaming within a dream. So in which case your dream would be consistent. And the people around you that you believe are evidence of the fact that reality is real would be consistent, because they're again part of your phaneron, as it is called. Mm. The reality that you consider to be the reality is consistent. But you may, when you die, you may wake up to another reality. It's the old story of Lao Tzu, isn't it? You know, thinking, was he a butterfly dreaming he was a man, or a man dreaming he was a butterfly?
That's right.
You know, and people never think of this, because one of the things that my forum, we were talking about this recently on my international forum, was the idea of these occasional dreams that people have that are life dreams. Do you know, you live a whole life in a dream. And then you wake up and you've had children and you've been loved people and you've lived a whole life. And for a few seconds when you wake up, you have this profound feeling of loss. And then it fades away like a snowball in the sun. And you don't remember it anymore. But you have deep in your heart this kind of feeling of there was somewhere else that you were, where you were a different person and lived a whole life. And these dreams are not that uncommon. That people do have these dreams. So in which case, going back to your original question about hypnagogic imagery is the scientific technical term for it is called REM intrusion. This is where what is happening is that rapid eye movement, in fact you are sleeping but you're still consciously awake. And this is of course allied to another phenomenon called sleep paralysis, where people wake up, or they think they wake up, but they're not really awake. There was a guy who phoned me in on one of my radio programs on UK radio, and he had this amazing thing. He had woken up, he cleaned his teeth, he'd gone downstairs, he'd driven to work, and he'd worked for the morning, and then he found himself back in bed waking up. He then gets up, does all everything else, and he gets to lunchtime, and he wakes up again. He did this 8 times. During that day. And again, it's the idea of what is the reality? You know, the reality, because when we dream, dreams seem real.
That's right.
You know, it's one of the things that people forget. They think, oh, I must be dreaming. But we never get into that state of thinking we're dreaming unless we're adept lucid dreamers. You know, effectively, we believe the reality we are in is as real as this reality is. And that is because it is. We go into these other worlds. I don't know if you get them, but I also get these strange dreams where I go back to the same places.
Oh, yeah.
I recognize the geography.
That's
you
right.
know what's going to be around the corner.
I have a city that I return to now and then, walk around in like a virtual reality world, basically. Very interesting.
And of course, that is, you know, that is because that is a real place. And what is happening is that you are, as Robert Monroe said, Robert Monroe, when he wrote Journeys Out of the Body, one of the things he stated was he used to visit a place called Locale 3. And in Locale 3, he used to inhabit the body of another person that he called either. And he used to go back into this person's body. And for a few hours, he'd be this person. Then he'd wake up and he'd go back again a few weeks later to being this person a few seconds after the last time he visited. You know, and what does this say about the nature of reality? And of course, it comes down to the mystery of time.
That's right. You know, the whole idea is that it's far more elusive than we give credit for. And of course, we're kind of in a comfort zone where we think we like to know, in a sense, what is going on. But there's much more behind the phenomenon. Anthony, I want to take the opportunity to before we take a little break here, obviously, to make sure that we mention your latest books and give out your website and so forth, because we have... You mentioned three titles. I'm aware of The Out-of-Body Experience, The History and Science of Astral Travel. That's the one from November now. It's been out for about 3 months. And then the latest one that I knew about was Making Sense of Near-Death Experiences, a handbook of clinicians. And this is co-authored, of course. You can mention those as well. And then you have a third book that I want you to tell us about as well then.
Okay, yeah, the first one, The Out-of-Body Experience, is published by Watkins. And if anybody's interested in checking the background to this book as well, it was reviewed today in the UK magazine 40 and Times and was given a 9 out of 10 by the managing editor, Bob Rickard, which I'm absolutely delighted to have that. And also, if you look up on YouTube and look up Anthony Peake, you will find a video of me doing the inaugural talk at Watkins Bookshop in central London about the book. The other book, The Out-of-Body Experience, a Handbook for Clinicians, I have written or I've edited with two Australian consultant psychiatrists. And what the three of us have done is we've got some of the world's leading authorities on near-death experience to write essays on the latest research in terms of near-death experience. And it's very much written from the viewpoint of doctors and nurses and clinicians, because what we're wanting is people out there, when they have a near-death experience, we want the doctors and the clinicians to be objective and report what the person says, rather than dismissing it and saying, oh, it's some form of hallucination. Because this phenomenon is far too common. It is a genuine phenomenon. Whether it is neurologically based or whether it is hallucination is beside the point. People do have these experiences, and they are part of humanity and the human experience. So we need to understand them more. And this is the whole point of this book. And we have people like Pim van Lommel, Professor Peter Fenwick, and various other individuals who have contributed chapters to it. The book that then my next book will be due out in April, and it's called The Labyrinth of Time. And this book I'm profoundly excited about because it is my take on how consciousness and how the observer perceives time. And rather similar to my last book on the out-of-the-body experience, I do a review of the history of the philosophy of time, and I discuss all the great philosophers of time. I then go into the science and neurology of science of time perception, how the brain processes time, how time seems to speed up under certain circumstances. But I also do the neurology of why this could be, including some really, really interesting research that's been done in recent years in terms of time perception. And I then move on to review time in popular culture. and I discuss movies that's based upon time, movies like Butterfly Effect, Groundhog Day, and various other films, and also time in poetry. I discuss T.S. Eliot and the four quartos, things like Burnt Norton. I also discuss the writings of Flann O'Brien and people like James Joyce, for instance, his book Finnegan's Wake. And I also discuss the philosophy of people like Peter Ouspensky and Friedrich Nietzsche and the idea of time as a circularity and the way in which something called the eternal recurrence can explain many of the observed phenomena we feel. And in the end, I then pull it all together again in the same way as I've done with my last book, of doing the science of it and trying to bring together a grand model that can explain out-of-the-body experiences and everything else in exactly the same way. And time is the thing, is the secret, I think. We are so hung up with time. If we realize that time is an illusion and time doesn't actually exist, and again, people out there will say absolute patent nonsense, but if you read the work of people like Julian Barber, who wrote an amazing book 10 years ago called The End of Time, you will realize that time isn't quite what it seems. Hmm. And again, I'm reminded of the very, very famous quote by St. Augustine, when he turned around and said that when people ask me what time is, I understand it straight away. But as soon as I start to think about it, I suddenly realize I haven't got a clue what it is. That's exactly what I'm writing about.
Yeah. Wow. Fascinating. And of course, everyone can pick up copies of your latest books at anthonypeake.co.uk. And the last name here for the guys who when I have it spelled out is P-E-A-K-E, Peak, anthonypeak.co.uk. And I think Making Sense of Near-Death Experiences, that's from another publisher, but you have a link from there. How about the new one that's coming out there?
Yeah, the new one is published by Arcturus, which is the publisher of my first two books. The book on the out-of-body experience is by Watkins. And at the moment, I'm pitching for another book, which I'll be dealing with the pineal gland and the mysteries of the pineal gland in terms of how that could be a stargate, for want of a better term, to alternate realities.
Wow, interesting. You're tying all the loose ends together here, obviously.
Very much so. Yeah. I feel that we're really pulling it together. But one thing I think it's very important is that I know, Henrik, you're a member as well, my international forum on anthonypeake.com/forum, because here we now have over 1,000 people worldwide who contribute ideas, thoughts, and feelings. We have many, many internationally known writers. We have scientists. We have psychologists. We have philosophers, all discussing the implications of my ideas and taking them forward. Because one thing I always stress is that my overall concept of cheating the ferryman no longer belongs to me. It belongs to everybody, and people are taking it to the most amazing places. We have people making movies based upon it. We have people writing poetry. We have people writing rock operas on it. We even have a young Canadian from Toronto who's launched a line in men's underwear based upon the whole concept of my Damon Adelon idea.
Genuinely true.
Stretches it a little bit.
I'd like to see that, how that's implemented. That's fascinating, yeah.
Absolutely. It's called Bozak Clothing. If anybody wants to check it out, it's B-O-Z-A-C-K. Bozak Clothing. He has a website, and again, he discusses why he feels that his daemon had guided him to do this work.
Well, there you go. Interesting. Well, the forum as well there, I want to give a plug out for that, anthonypeake.com/forum. Get involved and, of course, share your stories there as well, because the more and more we add to this, and this is about infecting, if you will, the mass consciousness in a good way, in a positive sense, of trying to get the ideas out there in a sense, because I think there's something to this as well, than of the 100th monkey syndrome, in a sense, that if the more and more people get aware of this and start thinking about these, I think the more and more doors, if you will begin to open up into this very, very strange phenomena that we, you know, commonly refer to as reality. There's just so much more to discover and so much more I want to talk with you about after we return from the break, Anthony. So stay with us, and we'll be right back for more.
I'm in someone else. trying to find. Like a picture on the wall, waiting for my face to fall. I'm in someone else's mind. I'm in someone else's mind. It ain't easy, it ain't kind. I'm a person you don't know, and sometimes it hurts you so, but I'm in someone else's mind. In someone else's mind. It's not exactly where I wanna be, in someone else's mind. It's not exactly what I wanted you to see, from how it used to be. Exactly where I wanna be, in someone else's mind. It's not exactly what I wanted you to see, from how it used to be.
We specifically address the mystery of the pineal gland, the third eye, or our personal stargate, as Anthony calls it, in the next hour. Ancient people around the world seems to have had an understanding of the pineal gland and its importance, as we can see in their use of pine cone symbolism. Anthony explains how the pineal gland first appears in the developing human fetus at the 49th day after conception. At first, it's located in the back of the throat and then gradually moves upward and inward during gestation to be finally located in the center of the brain. Interesting stuff. We move on to discuss DMT, plants containing specific chemicals that can open us up to the concept of God. This is a fascinating continuation that you shouldn't miss. The second hour of this or any of our previous programs is now available in our members area. If you're yet not a member, you're welcome to subscribe and get access to our entire archive filled with gems on everything that we consider to be interesting and important. The topics are just way too many to list here, but have a look around. We urge you to use our search function, and I believe that you can find something that you've been looking to find out more about. If not, please let us know. Maybe we can bring a new perspective to light. Red Eyes Radio continues to bring you fascinating radio with people like Sonia Barrett, Stephen Bassett, Barbara Hanklau, Carl Munk, Gerard Williams, Paul Levy, Dean Pfeffer, James Gilliland, Laird Stranton, David Icke, Robert Chalk, Håkan Blomqvist, Louise Turi, and J.J. Hertak, together with Desiree Hertak. But that's later, this is now, and hour two of Anthony Peak is next up. Subscribe at redeyescreations.com. Thank you for staying with us.